You're listening to Band Geek with Richie Castellano on the Riotcast Network. Riotcast.com.
What's up, guys? Richie here. This is Band Geek episode 11 with Kasim Sultan. I'm so excited for you guys to hear this one. Kasim was incredible. He played great, he sang great, and he told some amazing stories. We did this one on June 12th. And we're going to split this up into a two-parter because it was kind of long. You might notice something towards the end. I think maybe the last 10 minutes or so, the sound might change a little bit. We had a little issue while we were recording with our digital clock and Pro Tools. If you're an audio geek, you'll know what I'm talking about. But if you're not, I'll explain it really quickly. Sometimes you have a clock issue where your devices won't sync up. And as a result, you get this really pleasant like crackling sound that sounds like on everything. So I was really bummed because Kasim was telling a really interesting story during that time, but I was able to salvage it actually by using Isotope decrackling software. Yes, that's an actual piece of software, and it did a really good job, but it changed the sound a little bit. So if you hear the sound change, it's not your system, it's on us, but hopefully it won't be too distracting. A couple other things I want to talk about. We have some Blue Oyster Cult gigs coming up with myself and Kasim. We're playing in Costa Mesa, California at the Pacific Amphitheater with Deep Purple on August 6th. That's coming up. And then on August 8th, we're playing in Lincoln, California at the Thunder Valley Casino Resort, again with Deep Purple. So if you're in the California area, if you're near any of those shows, check them out. You get to see Blue Oyster Cult and one of my favorite bands, Deep Purple, with one of my favorite guitar players, Steve Morse, and one of my favorite keyboard players, Don Airey. So that's going to be an awesome show. Just a few more things I want to mention. If you want to help out the show, go to iTunes, rate the show, and leave comments. That helps us out tremendously, especially when we're trying to get new listeners. So we really appreciate that. And if you want to support the show, what you can do is go to our Amazon portal. What that means is next time you're going to go to Amazon to buy something, instead of going to Amazon.com, you want to go to Riotcast.com/BandGeek. And at the top of the page, you'll see an Amazon.com banner. And you click on that link, and that takes you to Amazon just like you'd normally see. The only difference is every time you make a purchase, a few pennies go to our show. And that support will help us out a lot. So next time you're going to shop on Amazon, make sure you go to Riotcast.com/BandGeek. Another thing I want to talk about is this show is the first time we're using all Audio-Technica microphones and headphones. Audio-Technica was nice enough to hook us up. Please check them out also. That's audio-technica.com. We're going to talk about that later on in the show as well. Before we get started, I want to give you some background information on our guests. I've been told that sometimes I assume people know who the guests are. So if you don't know who Kasim Sultan is, Kasim is a well-known bass player, singer, and songwriter. And He's most well-known for being a member of Utopia. Also, he's been in Todd Rundgren's band for a long time. He's also on, he toured with Meatloaf for a while, and he's on Bat Out of Hell 1 and 2. So, you know, those are two of the best-selling albums of all time. And he's the bass player on those albums, and you can hear him singing background vocals and stuff like that. And he's also a current member of Blue Oyster Cult, and that's how I know him. Aside from him being a Staten Island resident, which is where I live, his other credits include Joan Jett, Cheap Trick, Hall & Oates, Patti Smith, The Indigo Girls, Steve Stevens. He has a lot of great credits under his belt. He's an amazing guy, and we had a lot of fun with him. So that's it. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the Band Geek Podcast. I'm Richie Castellano. With me is my co-host, Jarrett Pressman.
I want you to start calling me by my changed podcast name.
Muff?
No, Mo Pleasure.
Mo Pleasure.
Okay. That's what I'm changing my name to.
Okay.
Hashtag more kazoo.
All right, take two. Here we go. Welcome to the Band Geek Podcast. I'm Richie Castellano. With me is my ho-host.
My ho-host.
My ho-host.
Okay, all right, take three. Serious face. Welcome to, this is all making it in, by the way. Well, welcome to the Band Geek Podcast. I'm Richie Castellano. With me is my co-host, Mo Pleasure.
What up?
On drums is Andy Ascalise.
Hello, everybody.
Vocals, my wife, Anne-Marie Castellano.
Yep.
Our audience of one, Brandy Metaxas.
It's an audience of two.
We have an audience
now.
Of two today. Audience we have two. Susie Ziegler with us. Hi, Susie.
Hello.
And our special guest for today, Kasim Sultan.
That sounded like there was 15 people on this show. Yeah. Really good.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Oh.
I really appreciate being here.
Thank you for being here. Wait till I do this in post. It's going to sound like there's 100 people here. It's going to sound like a gig. Oh my God, with that new microphone, you really Wait, all your effects like, are really coming through.
It'll only sound like a gig if we have to travel 18 hours to get to it and play five songs.
Oh my God.
What new microphone are you talking about?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Segway Sam.
Your voice sounds extra lush today.
Everybody sounds so good today. What's going on?
Rich, you have more velvet on your voice.
Today is actually the first podcast we've recorded using all Audio-Technica microphones and headphones. This is a big deal. Audio-Technica, now this is not an ad, because later on we'll have ads, but this is not an ad. This is real. I've been using Audio-Technica stuff since I'm a kid. When I got my first recording rig, the broken three-track that my uncle gave me, he gave me the broken Tascam tape deck, and he gave me a working Audio-Technica dynamic microphone that I used constantly until I graduated to the 4033, which is what I've been using. Every album I've recorded has a 4033 on it. Every YouTube video I've done is a 4033. I love this microphone. I learned about it in college from my professor, who is a real deal professional mixer, and he told me use the 4033. It's the most underrated microphone. It does everything. And also, I used this on Regina Spektor's album on the bass, on the upright bass, and I use it on a bunch of stuff. I love this mic, and Audio-Technica hooked us up big time, and they sent us a bunch of really nice stuff. Say hello on your new 4040 muff.
Hello, Audio-Technica fans.
Oh my God, that is so nice. And Anne-Marie and Andy have, I don't know what those models are.
M510.
That's very geeky of you to know that. Very good.
Anne-Marie opened all the boxes.
She did.
I did. It was like
it was like Audio-Technica Christmas, dude.
It was so wonderful. It was technology Christmas.
Hey, actually, talk to your mic again, Muff.
Check, 1, 2.
Oh, it sounds so good. And the
it 44... rumbles in my stomach.
Kasim, because
without
special...
Audio-Technica microphones, I don't like this.
But with Audio-Technica technology.
Kasim's actually talking into the 4047. Say hello, Kasim.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, it sounds
How
so
are you?
It's
so
smooth.
It sounds like he's right here.
I am.
Oh, my God. So this is a really big deal for me because I grew up on Staten Island. And when you grow up on Staten Island, there are a few people you hear about as myths and legends. And, and they're not all Jersey Shore cast members.
You mean like the homeless wizard underneath the Bayonne Bridge?
Or California, the homeless guy at the bus shelter.
Why are all the legends about homeless people?
Well, there's Cropsey.
Well, there's a really long list of musicians that were born in Staten Island. Were you born here?
No, I was not. I was born in Coney Island, Brooklyn.
We got to talk to Wikipedia.
Really?
About that. Yeah, you said born in Staten Island.
Oh, I can change that.
You can.
Yeah.
Yeah, so can I. That's the genius of Wikipedia.
But anyway, I being a Staten Islander, especially a musician, you hear the name Kasim Sultan over and over and over again. So I was really nervous to meet you.
You were?
I was very afraid because I've heard some pretty interesting things.
I'm a really horrible person.
But we've compiled a list of facts that we researched and stuff we've heard on Staten Island about you, and we'd like you to either confirm or deny the following facts. Okay. If you will please, Jared. I'm sorry, Mo Pleasure. You will please bring the facts.
Okay. They're not all Staten Island specific, but there's a rumor that you get your glasses made from leftover parts of the Verrazano Bridge.
True.
True?
That's true.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I knew that was true.
Because I'll tell you, the funny thing is that when they were building the bridge, my dad took us, me, my sister and myself, and I think it was like 1961 or 62, and they were building the bridge, and he stole an I-beam and brought it home. And so ever since, I've been chopping off little pieces of it. And creating these one of a kind frames that no one has ever had.
He just out-comedied us.
Yeah.
Just
yep. All right,
so that's a true one. Okay, what else you got?
Kasim used to babysit Staten Island musician Ingrid Michaelson.
True.
Wow. Okay, so you've known her for a while then.
Who? Wait.
Actually,
she's great. She's great. I would love to meet her. If you know, if you have a hookup for
just Wikipedia. I only know her through Wikipedia.
I
don't
know.
Okay, so let's see. Kasim was the musical director in the first production of the musical Hair, written by Staten Island composer Galt McDermott.
No, but I actually I auditioned for the movie.
Did you?
Really?
Yes, I really did, for Milos Forman and Twyla Tharp.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
I auditioned for Hair, the movie.
Did you audition for anybody specific or just general?
I auditioned for Milos Forman and Tharp.
No, for the any particular role.
Oh, Wolf.
Nice.
Yeah.
He would have sang Sodomy.
That's what I sang for the audition. And do you want to know something? I swear to God, this is the God's honest truth. I was called in for the audition, and they gave me the two or three songs to learn, and one of them was Sodomy. And there was a piano player in the audition. There was about 30 people in the room, and I listened to it over. I had the vinyl record. I put it on the turntable. I sang to it for days. And I get to the audition, and he goes, the piano player does, bum, blah, 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 you know, does the thrill up, and I blanked. I could not, for the life of me, remember even the melody of the song. Or the
first
song
word is sodomy.
It wasn't about the word, it was I couldn't sing it, so I wound up playing one of my own songs.
Right.
Nice.
But I didn't get the part.
Oh.
Obviously.
Yeah. Snug Harbor was originally named Sultan Harbor.
No, I'm going to have to deny that one.
I did not. The first three were true.
These are facts. I've been compiling this list over the years.
You know, that is true, actually. And I made them change it. I didn't want my name associated with because. So I suggested they call it Snuggly Harbor. And they really didn't want to do that. So they shortened it to Snug.
Kasim has been married to two of the three Indigo Girls.
There's no three. There's only two.
Two of the two.
There's only two.
It's a vicious rumor.
I played on one of the records.
Really?
Which one? Yeah, I played bass.
These facts were pulled from actual facts.
I forget what record it is, but I played on the song called Cana.
Cool.
Yeah, that's me playing bass.
Okay. And this is last one. Despite being the 10th uncredited member of the Wu-Tang Clan, which I've heard, you are the credited 11th member of the Wu-Tang Clan. True or false?
Actually, my original moniker was Young Dirty Bastard.
Actually, I have some other ones that I've compiled. This is I'm not even kidding about this one. This is not a joke. That Kasim played on Bat Out of Hell when he was only 13 years old. Is that true or false?
That's false. I'm tired of making the falsities true. So it's just false. I'm not even going to say anything. Yeah.
Okay. Was there another one that it?
Yeah. Go ahead.
How old were you when you played on that album?
20.
20.
Yeah.
The real version is my friend Lane. He was one that used to tell me legends of Kasim.
Right.
You know,
I love that game.
Kasim went on tour with Meatloaf and played on the album when he was 17. So he was only off by 3 years. Right. It's not bad. Let's play a tune right now.
Okay.
We do this thing where we teach people the songs that we're about to play, and that's a clever way for us to rehearse the songs before we play them, so we don't bungle them when we actually do them. So we're going to do one that you wrote,
yes,
Set Me Free from Utopia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was their only hit, right?
This this song was the only top 30 hit that, or actually top 20 hit that Utopia ever had.
Awesome.
As a band. Now, there were other other songs. There was Love is the Answer that was a big hit for England Dan and John Ford Coley, and it was also covered by a few other people. Then there was another song called Mated that was covered by someone and it became a big hit for someone else. But it was the only song that Utopia did that was successful.
Now, this one's pretty complicated. I mean, Utopia is definitely one of those progressive bands with in terms of complexity. And so this is a perfect band geek song.
Really, you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this song's tricky. I think so. All right. C minor, right? That's what we're starting on.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't have to write this down because you know this song. You wrote this song.
All right.
That's all right. Sorry. No, we're good. I know it. So, so this is like a C minor to a B flat.
Yes.
And the bass line goes...
I was written on piano, so...
You wrote this on piano?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. In my mom's basement, actually, not too far from here.
Really?
On a Wurlitzer. I wrote it on a Wurlitzer.
Is that what's on the record?
Yes. It's a Wurlitzer double-tracked on the record. It's just a C minor, C minor 7, actually.
Yeah, C minor 7.
And the bass goes up chromatically to... right. Yeah.
So, I can't do it on guitar, but
I'll play the...
One, two, three, four.
Oh, wait a second. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Okay. Okay.
Three, four. Yeah, so that's it. Yeah. So, those chords are... So, if you want to play along, gang, pick up your guitar and it's or your keyboard. Don't pick up your keyboard. Sit at your keyboard. I picked up my keyboard and now I need a hernia operation.
I'm going to sue.
I'm going to sue. Damn you, Bandy. So, okay. So that's C minor, like back and forth to B flat. I'm doing this, I mean, it's on keyboard, but if you want to play on guitar, I'm doing like the third fret.
Yeah, it's a double bar position. Yeah.
Then F, B flat. All right, so that's the intro. Yeah, we'll do a few more times.
2-5-1.
Yeah, 2-5. Thank you, Theory Police. You know, I got a bone to pick with you, Andy. I'm sorry, Kasim. I hate to do this in front of you.
I don't know numbers.
When did you become the fucking first inversion police? I'm listening to the other, you know, I go, oh, so the song goes, you know, F over, that's first inversion. And then it goes down to B flat of it, that's first inversion. Like, okay, I know it's first inversion.
He's not being
I'm just giving information.
He's doing it in such a jerky way, Brandy.
I've been studying, like, theory since I was, like, 8.
Okay, Andy.
I'm sorry.
Fine. All right. You know what?
That's another lame
first
story.
First inversion chords are
Andy
awesome.
Andy Escalise has been studying theory since he's, like, 3 years old.
You know, the funny thing is I've been doing this for 40 years. I haven't got a fucking clue what you're talking about. I'm the first inversion, second inversion.
It's all right. You don't need to. We're going to just do this.
Okay. 6/4.
Okay, okay.
Right. 6/4?
Keep it in your pants for now. We're going to talk about some chords now.
That's just some useless shit.
Yeah. That's college shit.
Figure bass.
So there's the intro. Now, the... it goes to F. And you sort of jam on the F.
Yeah,
you
know, it's like a Chuck Berry F. Yeah.
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 And then you go to a G7th.
Yeah. And then C
then
sus.
C. Now is it a C sus? Because I'm hearing a few different
it's
things.
It's C sus 7 to C sus.
Oh, okay. So because I was hearing a B flat and it's like.
No, it's actually.
Oh
yeah, because it follows
so it's
the
like
melody.
A nine.
Gotta write to who I am. No, but you play it in the C. You play it in the double bar position.
Really? Okay. Yeah. And I gotta put a D in there somewhere. I'm blanking right now. Right there.
Right. Oh, okay. Exactly. Duh. Yeah. It's really simple.
So it's like a C sus to C 7 to C sus 2. Yeah. And then we have this A minor 7 flat 5, or you want to, what's the other name of it, Andy? Go ahead.
Half diminished.
Very good, Andy. Let's everybody applaud Andy. Very good.
Why are you picking on me?
because it's your turn.
Yeah, but
Phil's not here.
That's the right name of the chord. That's the correct name of the chord.
As a matter of fact, I looked at it as an F before I thought it was an A an A flat, whatever.
An F. Okay. Well, I'm hearing a A. Yeah, A minor 7 flat 5 or A half diminished, and then D7 sus 4 D7. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's crazy.
Well, if you're looking at it as an F, awesome. Then it's the first inversion.
You can't see my face on the podcast, but it's not pretty right now.
But you can hear your face on these brilliant Audio Technica microphones. You can hear your face crinkling up.
Okay, so you got those chords. It's F, jam on F, jam on G7th, C7 sus 4, C7th, C7 sus 2, or C. We'll just call that whatever. C7th, yeah, 9. And then A minor 7 flat 5. D sus 4, D7 sus 4, D7. And then we go back to the
Right. That's really the whole song.
And then there's the bridge. It goes chromatic up from the F, G minor, and then it was like E flat major 7th or something.
Uh-huh.
And then, go ahead, Andy.
It's first inversion.
It's B flat with a D in the bass. Is that correct?
Yes.
This is awesome. I get to ask the person who wrote the song if I'm right. And I feel so, like, every time I do a correct chord, I want to hear, like, ding, 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 ding. Anyway.
Okay, it and needs then to be a sound that denotes first inversion, too. Like, we need to come up with something for that.
Every time I play it.
Ba-da. All
right, if you want to know what a first inversion is, all it is you take a chord. Let's look at this B-flat chord. Thank you. You take a B-flat. You're an asshole. So I take this B-flat chord. B-flat chord is B-flat, D, F. First inversion is instead of having the B-flat in the bass, you have the D in the bass.
I call it the Layla chord. It's the second chord in the end of Layla.
If you're a guitar player, you call it slash chord. B-flat slash D.
No, but you know what? That's fine. But you can slash over anything. Like, for example, it doesn't have to be the third in the bass. It could be anything. So calling it a first inversion is actually way more helpful.
I get it.
That's two against one now. Okay.
I have a question. What if that's the first inversion? What's the second?
Okay, so if let's let the expert field this one.
The second inversion is when the bass plays the fifth of the chord.
So if it's a B flat, it would be.
Like, and if there's
the Elton John chord.
Yeah, and if it's a seventh chord, you go up one more, and then it's third inversion when the seventh's in the bass.
So if it's a B flat seventh.
So if it's like
it would be.
Uh huh.
There you go.
Oh wow.
So that's now everybody knows what Andy's talking about. Okay.
That's useful information.
It's first inversion.
So anyway, back to the bridge. The bridge is G minor.
Let's take it to the bridge.
E flat major 7th. B flat with a D in the bass.
First inversion. 6-4.
A minor 7th, right? It's regular this time. Back to the D.
It's actually a D sus.
D sus?
Yeah.
Okay. So A minor D sus. Then it repeats that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we do it a few times, and then and then the solo ends on the C.
Yeah. To get back to the verse.
And back to the verse. Now, on the record, there's a modulation.
Second inversion.
Oh, can we just play the damn song?
There's a modulation at the end of the song.
Yeah, but we don't need to do that today, right?
We're not going to do that.
Okay. But there's like a two bar, and then it goes. That's crazy. I love that part. This song's pretty high, huh?
It was high at the time, yeah. I was high at the time, actually. It's like,
we're gonna
put the lights up.
Oh yeah, let's put the lights up.
Should I write those chords up here?
No, it's all right. We got it. Actually, someone told me that they take out a. Someone wrote on my Facebook. They take out a piece of paper and they write them as we're saying them. So they can read the chart, which is really awesome. So,
that's cool.
Yeah, I hope everybody's able to catch those. And if not, just Facebook me, and I'll write them down on the Facebook. Kasim and Jules Rodino, the drummer from Blue Oyster Cult, we had like a trio that we were doing for a while, and Kasim and I actually recorded a track to this. So this is very good, because now Andy doesn't have to go back and play keyboards. So what you're going to be hearing is Kasim playing keyboards. And background vocals. Yeah.
And bass at the same time.
So if you don't see a keyboard player,
it's still live.
It's still live. Yeah. It's but it's Kasim from months ago.
It's past Kasim.
All right. And I'm very high tech.
Oh, actually, here's another just a quick interesting fact. Mm-hmm. When we recorded this song, the basic track was myself and the drums.
Really?
Myself and Willie Wilcox.
Were you playing keyboards?
I played piano, and Willie played along with me. And so that was the basic the basic track was just keyboards and drums. I overdubbed bass, and then Todd and Roger Powell and Todd Rundgren put everything else on it.
Do you remember the bass line from the record? Because I was listening to it. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's for the verse.
Yeah.
It's a... It's like,
that's awesome.
It's like, yeah, it's just real kind of McCartney-ish. Yeah.
They sound so great in our Audio Technica headphones.
All right. See if I can do this. Are you okay, Brandy? Brandy's
gonna start now?
Yeah. The recording in the back, the red button with the picture of like
a camera?
Yeah.
A picture of a ghost
okay,
on it.
We're good? Yeah. Okay. Here we go. Are you ready? Andy, you ready?
Yeah.
Here we go.
Was that a good sax solo?
That was excellent. That was really cool. Not that anybody asked, but
that's the point of this show. We're the biggest question. The answer to the question.
That song
no one
is
asked.
Not about. It's not girl and boy song. It's about me trying to get out of a record deal.
Really?
Yeah.
Who was the record dealer?
Well, when I joined Utopia, we saw the first record contract that we signed, we all signed collectively as a band, and we signed solo contracts individually as band members.
Wow.
So Bearsville Records was obligated to put out a solo record from each band member. I immediately started working on what I hoped was my first solo record. I had like 100 hours free studio time every year in Bearsville Studios. Which was an amazing studio. Anyway, I did a bunch of demos, handed them to Albert Grossman, who's a very, very famous manager, and he managed Janis Joplin, Bob Dylan, he managed Todd, he managed the band. And he said, you know, you're not ready. And I said, listen, I'm ready. Don't tell me when I'm not ready, because I know that I'm ready. And he said, well, you're not ready. I said, okay, fine. Well, you know what? Then let me go, and I'll go somewhere else and see if someone else thinks that I'm ready besides me. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, that's fine. You can go. Just, you know, that'll be $100,000 and 15 points off your next record.
What?
Yeah. And he did nothing for me. He had absolutely nothing. But he made money off of not doing anything for me.
Oof. Jeez. So, yeah. I mean, did they actually intend to make solo records, or were they just trying to
I think they just tried to placate Todd, you know, because it was really Todd's band. You know, Todd really, it was one of his pet projects.
Now, obviously, he was a solo artist before then.
Mm-hmm. And they wanted to keep him happy. Mm-hmm. So they said, oh, you want your band to have record contracts? Okay, we'll give them record contracts. Don't worry about it, Todd. It's okay. and they never intended to do any solo records for us.
Oh, man. Yeah. But you can't release your own solo record.
No, you can't, because I was under contract with
them. That sucks.
Yeah.
So the what was the first tour you were on? What was the first like your first big band or album or whatever? What happened first?
The first record that I did was right after joining Utopia. Todd produced a record for a guy by the name of Steve Hillage.
Okay.
Who's pretty popular, I guess, in some circles. And that was the first record that I did. Was like about a month after I joined the band. And Don Cherry played on that record. A trumpet player, cornet player, I think. Jazz trumpet player. A couple of other people played on it. And so that was the first proper record that I ever did, you know, just as soon as I joined the band.
And what album was that?
It's called L.
Okay.
Steve Hillage, L. Then we recorded the first Utopia record after that, which was Raw.
This is before Bat Out of Hell?
Yeah. And then that winter, we started Bat Out of Hell.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have a Facebook question about Bat Out of Hell, actually.
All right. Well, who's it from?
Daniel Simon.
Okay.
He wants to know, were you surprised as everyone else when Bat Out of Hell did as well as it did?
Well, what happened was we rehearsed for 3 weeks in the studio, myself, Todd, Roy Bittan, and Max Weinberg, both from the E Street Band. We rehearsed all the songs for about 3 weeks in a small rehearsal studio up in Bearsville. Went into the studio, recorded everything, just the four of us. We recorded all the basic tracks in like one take. And we just laughed through the whole thing. Because
it's what we do here.
Personally, I never thought that I would ever hear that record again. Never, ever in a million years. Never hear.
Was it just too out there?
It wasn't so much that it was out there. It just wasn't what you would expect a successful record to be. It was totally camp. It was kind of Bruce Springsteen-ish, but yet it was Phil Spector-ish. And,
right.
But we, you know, I mean, we took it seriously when we were working on it, but afterwards we were like, we're going to hear this thing again.
Did Todd produce that?
Yeah, okay. Todd produced the whole record. So about a year later, I'm driving up to Woodstock. I was still living at my mom's house. I drove up to Woodstock, and on my way up, I'm listening to WNEW, and I hear something on the radio that sounds oddly familiar. And I'm like, where have I heard that before? That's the record I played on. I played on that record. How do you like that? That's so cool. And now it's the third biggest selling record of all time.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
I think it's Thriller, Dark Side of the Moon, and Bat Out of Hell.
That's unbelievable. Now, so you said you were living at your mom's.
Mm-hmm.
The first gig was with Todd.
First gig was with Todd.
How did that happen?
I was playing piano with a girl by the name of Cherry Vanilla in Manhattan. She was a rock poetress. She was actually David Bowie's publicist, and she was very popular in the underground music scene, the punk rock music scene in the city at the time. It was like 1974, 1975. And she hung around with a lot of like very famous and successful people. One of the people that she introduced me to and that I got to meet was like Mick Ronson. And
wow.
Mick was a really, really good friend of mine and a big champion in my early career. The other person was Michael Kamen. And Michael Kamen used to be in a band called the New York Rock Ensemble. Later, he was the piano player for David Bowie. He played on the Diamond Dogs tour.
And he did all that orchestration, right? The same guy?
Well, that's who he became, okay. this heavy orchestrator. He did like Band of Brothers. He did all the Die Hard movies.
Yeah.
He was a hugely successful and brilliant composer. And Michael kind of took me under his wing and said, you know, I'm going to help you out. I'm going to teach you how to play piano properly. And he was also friends with Roger Powell, who was in Utopia at the time. Another guy, a Staten Islander, Earl Slick, was a friend of mine. And somehow he was in touch with Michael because they were in David Bowie's band at the same time, the Diamond Dogs tour. And Michael called Earl Slick and said, hey, by the way, Todd Rundgren is looking for a bass player. If you know of anybody, you might want to pass that information along. Well, a friend of mine came over to my house. He said, I got to take Slick to the airport tonight. You want to take a ride with me? I said, yeah, sure, no problem. So we got in his truck. We drove two blocks from my mom's house over to Slick's house. And we got out of the truck and went to get his luggage, bring it in the van to take him to Kennedy. And he said, by the way, Todd Rung was looking for a bass player. Either one of you guys want to do it? And I said,
that's not real.
Yeah, sure, I'll try.
That's the way that everything happens, I feel like.
Yeah, I'll try. And he said, okay, call Michael Kamen when you get to the airport and let him know. So I called Michael Kamen as soon as I got to JFK, and Michael says, you're a bass player? And I said, yeah, I'm really, actually, before I'm a piano player, I'm a bass player. He said, I'll recommend you hands down, don't worry about it. And the next day I got a call from Roger Powell.
Wow.
Yeah. Actually, I almost didn't get the call because I was sleeping and the phone kept ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. And I was just like, I don't want to answer the phone. Like, no point in answering the phone. It's not going to be for me.
When Eric called me to ask me if I want to be in Blue Oyster Cult, I was sleeping at the time. And then I thought I dreamt the whole thing.
Really?
Yeah. Because he was like, go back to bed. I was like, okay. And I went back to bed. And I woke up like an hour later, like, that was a nice dream of joining Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah. It's funny how things happen like that. Yeah.
So, okay, you're playing with Todd. When did Todd decide to morph Todd Rundgren into Utopia?
Well, he always had Utopia. Okay. There was always a separation between Todd's solo career and his band career. Okay. And as much as he wanted to make the band sort of when I joined the band, it was four people. Before that, it was like six people, and then there was seven people. Before that, Luther Vandross was in Utopia for a second. David Lasley, who is a wonderful background singer, sings with James Taylor. I think he still sings with James Taylor. There was a couple other famous people in and around Utopia at the time. But Todd always his work ethic was like he was just constantly doing stuff. If he wasn't producing a record, if he wasn't producing the band or Grand Funk or Cheap Trick or whoever, he was doing his own stuff. He was writing his own material. And then if he wasn't doing that, he was doing Utopia. So there was all these different kind of, facets of his career. And just Utopia was just one of them. That's all. And he wanted it to be a band. He didn't want it to be Todd Rundgren's Utopia. But unfortunately, his career was so huge that it eclipsed the rest of us. And it was always Todd Rundgren's Utopia.
So does anyone else from Utopia still play with him?
No, just me.
Just you? Okay, yeah. So now you don't do any Utopia material?
Yeah, we do. We do a couple of songs. Yeah, we do Love is the Answer, okay. Which is a big song for Utopia. Every once in a while, we'll do Love in Action, Trapped, which are kind of like, you know, the underground, like all the fans know those kind of songs.
Nice.
Yeah.
So now you toured with Meatloaf. When did that happen?
I did not. Well, I didn't tour with Meatloaf until 1993.
Okay.
And how that happened was I was playing with Hall & Oates at the time. They took a break. And I had some time off, and I was just kind of putzing around the house. I wasn't doing anything really important. And the phone rang one day. And let me back up a little bit, because myself, Todd, and a gentleman by the name of Rory Dodd did all the backgrounds on Bat Outta Hell 2. We sang on every song. It was just the three of us, like triple, quadruple track. There's like 27 background vocal tracks on each song.
Yeah, the production on that's pretty slick.
And for the most part, it's just the three of us.
Right.
I got reintroduced to Meat at that time. And, it was like, oh, hi, Cass, how you doing? And Jim, too. And then the record came out about a year and a half or almost 2 years after that the record came out, and they needed a utility guy, and he just said, you know, he called me and he said, are you interested in coming in and playing piano and keyboards? I mean, piano and background vocals and guitar for us.
Oh, so you did that first?
Yes.
How long did you do that for?
I did that from 1993 till 1997. And then in 1998, I became his musical director and bass player.
Okay.
Steve Buslow, who was in his original band, left, and then I stepped into the bass player's position.
What do you like better, playing, you know, keys and guitar or bass? What do you think?
I really like playing guitar. I'm not a great guitar player. I'm an okay guitar player. I play like really good my own stuff, you know, but other people's stuff is like, I'm not as adept at it as I am at being a bass player.
I've done both of those positions mm-hmm. in Blue Oyster Cult, and I played bass for maybe 2 or 3 years.
So did I.
Yeah. Andy's done every position. Yeah. It's going to be Andy's band before we know it. I'm primarily a guitar player, mm-hmm. so when I moved over to guitar, it was cool, but then there was the burden of playing keyboards, and Alan was a much better keyboard player than I am, mm-hmm. So that was a pain in the ass. But the thing I liked about bass more is that you're almost like the conductor of the mm-hmm. band. Like you influence the groove, and so if you like, you can make a difference. Like with the utility stuff, it's more like sprinkling. You
know, yeah, exactly. Like you're fairy dust.
Yeah, you're adding the stuff that people that's very ear catching. Yeah, like, ooh, I like that thing or that that string thing you did or that little lick you played. But with the bass, it's like you can say, oh, I don't like the way this is going, and you can change the way you mm-hmm. play and
absolutely.
Influence the whole. And that's, you know, I love what you bring to Blue Oyster Cult in terms of that. I think our groove is pretty awesome right now with you on bass.
Yeah, it's funny because it's only recently in the past, I guess maybe 5-6 months, that I've really settled into a very comfortable place with Jules. It takes a little bit to know how to second guess somebody and know what they're going to do before they do it.
Right.
And it's kind of like that now with me and Jules. We're kind of locked, and it feels really good.
It's fun to play with you guys.
Yeah.
And now, when you play with Meatloaf, were you on a click?
Not until the Pro Tools and
and
digital or audio
and stuff like that.
That was easier to use.
See, it's funny because people coming from that kind of background to play with us, you know, we're pretty old school in the mm-hmm. fact that we need to follow Donald's, mm-hmm. whatever path he goes on, and that could mean drastic tempo changes.
Mm-hmm.
So that when people start playing with us, sometimes that throws them for a loop.
We'll
sometimes just take off, and you have to because that's.
I'm surprised you guys don't play. I'm surprised that the band doesn't do more click work. You know, because it just sometimes you don't necessarily have to be married to it.
Yeah.
You don't. It's not written in stone, but it's nice to have that to have a starting point,
right?
You know, that's consistent.
The thing I'm realizing when I'm doing like these YouTube videos, when I do them, because I'm doing them all by myself, I need a click.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm doing like a Beatles song, the Abbey Road thing,
yeah,
those songs don't work in a locked tempo.
No, of course not, because they weren't recorded like that.
But like, I mean, like, I feel like sometimes when you're writing a song, you'll be playing something like, this song sounds great. Mm-hmm. This part goes right into this part. And then you put the click track down to go record the scratch track. And you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
This part doesn't go into the next part. You know what I mean? And I feel like sometimes it's a good, I mean, this is totally against everything I've done, but sometimes it's not a bad idea to just throw the click out the window yeah. and just say, this is how the song goes. It sounds good. Everybody has to just deal with that.
Yeah, it depends.
Don't fix it.
Exactly. But it also depends on the music, you know. It depends on the song. It depends on what kind of vibe you're going for, you know. Right. The worst thing is like trying to play to a click if it's a really slow song.
Yeah.
Know? That's really difficult. But, you know, if I had my druthers, I'd rather not play with a click, you know.
So when did you learn how to play? Was guitar first or bass first? All right, guys, that's it for this week. Check out next week's show for the end of that story. Plus, we're going to go into some detail on Kasim's gear and really geek out on basses, guitarists, and stuff like that. We're also going to play more music, and we're going to have a world premiere of one of the songs from Kasim's new album. So be sure to come back and check out next week's episode of Band Geek. Thanks for listening.